here from Athletes on the Rise on the Rise Up podcast, here with Nathan Cooper Brown down in Australia. How you doing, Nathan?
I'm great, Eric. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I've been looking forward to have you on here. And, you know, it's down there. It's the following day. So you're already on Friday. You're Friday. You're 15 hours ahead of us. And you're enjoying the morning as we're getting into our evening. Yeah,
that's right. But yeah. I can't give you any insight into the next day. So I wish I could.
I was going to say, it'd be nice to know where the stock markets and everything is going, but not possible. So let's jump right into it. So, you know, I have limited information about what I know about you through Joy, you know, Joy Burke, who I previously spoke to on this podcast. So, what I know, you do a lot of work with the national teams in Australia. You also work at the highest level, coach at the highest level, I believe in the women's league. So yeah, just give us the brief CV, the background, where you're at and where you came from.
Yeah, sure. I've been incredibly lucky to experience so many levels of basketball here in Australia. And it happened quite quickly, you know, thanks to a lot of people. Coming through the junior ranks, and we have a huge competition here in Victoria called the VJBL, Victorian Junior Basketball League, which has roughly about 1,500 games every Friday night. So it's huge. And,
wow.
That's
monstrous.
Started with under 14 teams there, and slowly, like most coaches, gaining experience, you know, putting in the work in professional development, just found more and more opportunities as I went. And about 8 or 9 years ago, my mentor, Laurie Chizik, who has just been a fantastic influence on me, and she'd be a great person to talk to, had an amazing journey herself. We kind of sat down and said, hey, you know, let's go do something cool. I think coaching's for me. And then it went from there. So I got involved in state teams, which allowed me to start doing some work at the junior national level in what we call brain development camps. Through there, I applied for some jobs at Basketball Victoria. Wasn't successful, but that allowed me to kind of be headhunted for a role at Basketball Ballarat, which is a big program in regional Victoria. And I went out there as the manager, athlete and coach development. And in my 3 years there, ran the program there. My second 2 years was involved in their semi-professional team, which works in our second-tier professional competition over here. That's where I met Joy, where she was one of our imports for the women's team. And part of my role there was skill development right the way through the program. With her, just having spent time with her and having her enjoy some workout, she spoke with Kelsey Griffin, who has played for the Opals and was currently with the Bendigo Spirit in the WNBL. And she said, hey, if you're interested in getting a good workout, I know a guy. KG and I had a couple of workouts, and she went to the staff at Bendigo Spirit and said, hey, I think we should bring this guy on. And so that got me into the WNBL. That was really short-lived. Mainly due to distance. So I was traveling about an hour and a half, you know, 3 hour round trip to kind of get there and get back. I was only there for quite a short period of time, but loved the experience. Loved working with the women, the coaching staff there, Simon Pritchard, David Flint. And then from there, came back, and at the same time through another big influence in my career, Justin Schuler, who was in the job I'm in now, he brought me on as the assistant coach for the Australian men's under 17 team. So that began my involvement in there. And then as that was happening, through some success and through, you know, a little bit more exposure and networking. I was offered a position with the Cairns Taipans in the NBL. Again, short-lived, got to work with the team for the preseason, working with the NBL Blitz tournament, helping them prepare for the season. Then we had the birth of our first child, so I had to say goodbye to that.
dangerous things,
yeah, that's right. And then we moved back home. My wife and I moved back home from Ballarat to Melbourne, continued coaching in the semi-professional league down here with a team here that was my junior club. And then in June of last year, I was employed to the job I'm in now, which is the high-performance head coach for Country Victoria Men. So that's in charge of Victoria Country. So that's everywhere in the state of Victoria besides Melbourne, in developing male athletes from we do a little bit of work for under 12s, but mainly under 14s through to under 18s. And through that role, I continue to be involved up at the COE with things such as Australian Development Camps, National Performance Camps. And this year, we were for the under 17 team was supposed to have the under 16 Asia Cup in Lebanon. And then we're still waiting to hear from FIFA. On whether we'll have a World Cup in Bulgaria in August. So, so that's just a little bit. Probably too long, but there's been so many cool things I've been able to do, and I'm really grateful for every one of them.
Yeah, no, I mean, that gives a good kind of overview and sets a good framework from, you know, where we kind of go and start speaking to a couple different things. So one thing I'm always curious about with coaches in other countries is kind of that educational development, the professional development, how it is in comparison to other parts of the world. You know, in America, we're kind of late to the game as far as how we educate our coaches, how we develop, you know, how that personal development is. A lot of it is just, you know, you get a mentor. You learn from them and you do what they do. That's what it's been traditionally. And Team USA has started to try to change that. But then you look at, you know, what they do in Spain. I mean, it's a 4 to 5 year process to be able to coach at the highest levels. And it's almost, you know, it's almost similar to like a collegiate degree. There's a lot of theory. There's a lot of paper write-ups. There's a lot of, you know, film study and on-court evaluations, so on and so forth. You know, what's it like down there in Australia? As far as how do you develop as a coach? Is it just something you do on your own, or is it something structured? How does that happen?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything, which is great. We have one of my colleagues actually at Basketball Victoria. His role is the coach development officer, so he's in assigned to develop coaches within our state, and most of our other states have similar roles. So coach development is a big part of what we're trying to do on a regular basis. We're similar to Europe. We have an accreditation system, which has been around for a while. It's had an adjustment. It's a five-part program, starting with club or domestic basketball, moving to association basketball, then performance, and then right up to your elite, which is your boomers and opals, your high national teams.
Yeah.
And then also I think one of the things that helps with coach development in Australia is a variety of opportunities to coach in different positions and at different levels through our junior programs, through our volunteer positions. There's obviously not as many professional positions like in the States, but for example, when I was coming through, I was the head coach of an under 14 team. I was the assistant coach for the state team at an Australian Junior Championships. I was the head coach of a 23 and under development league, which was part of that tier professional league. And then I was doing camp-based work as well. So just within a year, I was getting all those different experiences, being a head coach, assistant, camp, team, and then you add the accreditation system, and then you add, you know, the passion of any good coach to be a lifelong learner and, you know, find mentors, find different voices, find resources. And I think we get a really good mix down here to develop into the best coaches we can be.
Right. So with all those different levels, U14, assistant at the, for the state team, for the head coach, 23U team, camp-based work, et cetera, what, you know, in your way of doing things, how, you know, what's the mindset going into each level of how you're going to coach the players and develop them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Something that has shifted into the forefront of my mind, particularly as I get older and more experienced, is connection and transformational-based coaching. So it's getting to know the athletes. It's creating connection and relationships to show the guys I'm here for them. To prove to them that that this is going to be authentic, that this is going to be enjoyable, and is going to challenge them. Mm-hmm. So whether it's in a camp or team-based environment, it's trying to, you know, as soon as I walk through the door, it's talking to kids, it's talking to coaches, you know, hey guys, how you going? You know, whatever it may be, knowing that those touch points are the beginning of deeper relationships. The camp-based stuff, it's, you know, if you've got 200 athletes, it's as simple as having your sheet in front of you, which has, so all our kids will get, you know, numbers written on their leg or whatever it may be, and having that corresponding sheet to their name. And if you're one kid in 200 and here comes the head coach and uses your name, we know that that can go a long way. So that's definitely the beginning of the mindset. And then as I mentioned before, something that's a core value of mine is enjoyment, is joy. If we're not having fun, then we're doing something wrong. So, that's probably, my jumping off point, and then it goes from there.
Right. So how do you go about forming some of those connections throughout the year, you know, depending on the different personalities, those kids that are introverted, extroverted, that, you know, have those different personalities, you know, what are different, obviously you have the daily conversation, how's your day, you figure out what's kind of going on behind the scenes, you know, a little bit more in their personal lives with the families and friends and what they do for hobbies. But what are some other things that you get into to help kind of form some of those connections?
Yeah, I think kind of where you were heading there is the biggest part of it. The experience that I had last year in the NBL One, which is that professional, the Tier 2 professional league, we had a really tough year. We had lowest budget in the league. We had a lot of kind of roadblocks that made things difficult throughout the year. And to form a team, we ended up having so one of our players was a guy I actually played with a long time ago who was, I think he was 36 as our starting point guard. And then our starting shooting guard, who's about to go off to college, was 17. So obviously the discrepancy in age.
Yeah, that's an age gap.
Yeah. That's it. So obviously, you know, I'm not going to talk to Reese was our elder point guard and Kingsley was our younger shooting guard. I'm not going to talk to those guys the same way. So Reese had a young family. He played professionally around the world. For him, it was a lot more communication about what have you seen in the past? I'm putting something in here. Do you think this is going to work? You know, really embedding trust in him. That I value his experience, I value his worth. I can relate to him more on that, you know, around having a young family, having played previously. And then Kingsley, who, you know, is really driven, you know, wanted to get to college. You know, it's talking a little bit more about my college experience. So giving him some background and relating to him there. But even just, you know, what's happening, you know, more in pop culture, you know, mucking around and you know, poking some fun, particularly at myself, you know, a bit of self-degradation never goes astray. And that was really helpful in developing those two relationships.
Gotcha. So, and great example, kind of showing the age gap there as well. What about you've obviously coached, you know, men and women, boys and girls. How do you go about? Is there any way you go about forming those relationships differently?
Yeah, very much so. When I found that with coaching female athletes, you can never have too much communication. To the point where I had an experience with when I was the director up in Ballarat, and I think it was my first year there, and our 23 and under women's coach was unfortunately having some cultural issues within the team. And we kept having meetings about, you know, what's happening and where his struggles were happening. And for me, I said, have you spoken to that player about it? Okay, have you had a team meeting about that? Have you had a positional group meeting about that? I think probably the third time that we met and I had some similar advice, out of frustration, he yelled at, you know, he kind of yelled at, he said, God, do I have to have a team meeting with this group, you know, every week? And I just calmly said, yeah, you do. Because, again, from my experience, that's how I found that we could develop some really good culture within female teams and athletes, is by being really transparent, having great communication, having everybody feel like they had a voice. And then conversely with the men, it's not so much that you're going to have less communication. It's just usually quicker. It might just be, hey guys, this is what we're doing. You know, let's meet about it. Or it might be a leader coming and saying, no, we don't need to meet this week. So that was really the difference on just, you can never have too much communication with, a female team and with the guys. Sometimes they were happy to move on, a little bit quicker, in developing personal relationships. One of the biggest things for me with female athletes is that I was really big on not treating them like girls. Like they're athletes, and Joy and, you know, Kelsey Griffin and Nadine Payne and all these, women that I got to work with, they're elite athletes. And I wanted to show them, the ultimate respect and treat them as such. And I felt like that really went a long way in because they look after their bodies, they invest in the game, they love the game. And I felt that was the best way to do it. So I felt that was really helpful. And with the guys, it's just more of a relating to them through my own experiences was always something that started the relationship off on the right foot.
Right. So within that, then you have your skill development within those personal relationships that you develop. How, you know, what's the processes you go through at the different stages, youth through elite, to determine, hey, this is what we have to do right now to make you better for what, you know, this is what you need right now to get better for what you need.
Yeah. When we start off younger, it's definitely a framework around us kind of laying down the law a little bit. You know, here's what we've identified, particularly at your age group, that you need to have in your toolbox to be a successful player going forward. And it's kind of like, guys, you know, you got to trust us. This is what we're doing. And then as we get older, we start filtering in some film. We start filtering in more conversation, and to the point where if I'm working with Joy or, you know, one of the NBL One or NBL guys, those older professionals, it's a conversation. You know, what do you want to work on? What do you feel like you need to get done this session to be ready to go on Saturday night? Or, you know, watching the films, like, oh, hey, see, this is what I see here. you know, didn't quite get square on that shot. You know, that's something we can work on today.
Right.
Oh, my coach, I see that. Yeah, let's get into it. So, yeah, it's kind of like set out the framework, and as we get older, we start sharing the responsibility and the accountability.
Okay, so then how do you go from kind of introducing the skill and then getting it into gameplay? So, you know, when you're younger, obviously you have a lot of skills you have to work on. So you have to kind of divide up the time, or not just throughout the day, but then possibly throughout the season, have specific focus points. But then as you get into those older groups, what is it that you have to do you know what I'm saying? Like differentiate?
Yeah, 100%. So one of the things that I used to do as a younger coach was kind of follow that traditional on zero block practice. We're going to start with our fundamentals, you know, kind of first 20, 30 minutes. Let's say we're doing a 60-minute session. You know, we're going to go ball handling, passing, form shooting, and then maybe getting into some contested work or some more specific work around, you know, might be ball screen reads or post play, whatever that may be. But as I kind of got older and a little bit more experienced, for me, basketball is so much about the decision. Shots in particular, everything's so contested. Obviously, the higher you go. I was talking with the head of the COE the other day, who's also a assistant coach for the Boomers, who was at the recent World Cup, and he was talking about out of the 50% of shots taken by the Boomers were inside of 8 feet, and 40% were contested. So 40% of the 50% were contested. So a block... 5 to 10 minutes of on zero traditional layup work for me is no longer valuable. So we may start a session straight away, and it might be me, it might be a one-on-one if we've got maybe more athletes on floor at the same time, it might be grab a noodle or a pad, and we're straight into contested work. So we're straight into decisions, we're straight into the contest, we're straight into a game-like scenario, and then we use the block or the on zero if we need to go back to the technique or build something in that maybe that athlete doesn't have in their toolbox. And that's how I kind of frame a session now. And even for 60 minutes, I've found that I won't go below a 15-minute block. So I know I've seen session plans for coaches that may do, you know, we're doing 4 minutes here, 7 minutes here, 12 minutes here. For me, it's 4 15-minute blocks. We've got a success criteria or a point of emphasis for each of those. And then I've got some layered in kind of progressions within those 15 minutes of what we want to work on. So, yeah, that kind of sets out how we're working on our skill act. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's for, you know, the youth all the way up through elite. Like, you know, you block them off in those 15 minutes and you get into decision-making as much as possible.
That's right, 100%. You know, we may go back to a little bit more block work with the younger ages. Obviously, if we're hitting some areas of, you know, we're working the left-hand side of the rim, it's a 1v1 contested layup. A lot of kids keep coming back to their inside hand, so right hand, comfortable, but you're getting blocked. Okay, let's remove the defender. Let's get some touch on that left hand and then bring the defender back.
Right. Yeah. And within that, you know, as you see those competitive situations, you know, that's where as a coach, you have that coach's eye to determine like, hey, they, you know, this is what they have in their tool belt, but if they want to be more successful, you know, this is what they need. They need these different arm slots, and they need touch within these arm slots. They need this type of footwork. And it's, you know, it's that constant kind of push and pull of, okay, let's see where they're at. And all right, let's try to refine this skill a little bit, and then, you know, reintroduce it and talk about the situations, and then also have them feel those situations. So do you go right into competitive, or do you get them into decision making as far as, okay, hey, this is how the defense is playing you, this is how you should play it, And then you get into the full on reactive stuff, or does that depend on level? I mean, how do you differentiate on when to bring those things in?
Oh, we like to go into the reactive stuff straight away, to give the athletes that data of what it looks like in a game, of what it feels like, of what game speed is, of what an athlete or what a defender actually does. And then if we want to have that conversation around, okay, so, you know, this is what a defender may do, you know, here's some options around, you know, how we're building your toolbox, they've seen it and they've felt it, rather than a coach just, you know, saying, oh, this is what it, you know, is going to look like, you know. And that kind of links into something that also has happened in my coaching. As I've become more experienced, is I've really loosened the reins on how to do things on the floor. You know, originally being that kind of coach, you know, this is what the textbook says, or this is what my mentor says, or this is what I've seen on film, so this is how we're going to do it. But really, if you know, it's the players on the court. You know, they're the ones that have to execute and be successful, not me. So if they've got another way of doing it that feels more comfortable, that is successful, but maybe unorthodox, more than happy for them to continue to work on that and use that.
Right. So you just kind of take it as is, so to speak. So if a kid can finish on the left hand side with the right block, or with the right hand, but the defense doesn't necessarily defend it well, you just kind of leave it how it is until they get to that level where the defense is starting to do what they're, you know, defend it in a different way, and then you start to introduce different concepts, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, we won't necessarily wait until they're older. Like, we'll have the conversation with them about, hey, look, you know, you are being successful right now at this age because, you know, let's say you're 3 inches taller than everybody else, so you can just finish over the top.
Right.
But at the next level, you're going to need that left hand. And then, you know, putting that accountability back on the athlete to go away and understand, okay, coach has told me this, and this is something that I need to work on. And then we'll, you know, continue to work together to hopefully have that in place before the next level. But as we know, you know, some will work on it, some won't, and we got to deal with it as it comes.
So when you get into quote unquote skill work for, you know, those youth teams, those 14 and under, even 16, 18 and under teams, you know, how much of that time, you know, within those practices is dedicated to like the skill development, and then how much of that is dedicated to the tactical part?
For kind of under 14s and under, it would be at least, you know, 60-70% of the session would be that skill act, that fundamental work around our ball handling, our passing, our finishing, our form shooting. But all done again, you know, with as much decision making and kind of game scenario work as possible. Something that we've to talk a little bit about philosophy. Something that we've been really good on in our program is allowing players to play with a lot more freedom and creativity. Something in Australia that I think has kind of hamstrung us for a long time is we've been very rigid. We've had a certain way of doing things, which has been great. You know, we played in a very textbook way, but the game has evolved and we need to evolve with it. And you watch the Europeans in particular, and the flair and the ability to make creative plays and problem solve around what the defense is doing is something that we're really trying to work towards. Finishing is a big one for us. We just haven't been working on it enough. Every session I leave, I feel like I've done enough finishing, and then I think about it more, or I listen to a podcast, or I watch some film. I'm like, we haven't done enough. You know, with the simple notion of the game's about putting the ball in the hole. So trying to get more time in a session to work on finishing, contested finishing, building an individual skill development, you know, toolbox. It's interesting at the moment. We're definitely in an exciting phase of changing how we do things.
Sure. So what are some of the biggest challenges you're seeing as far as creating more abilities to finish, or, you know, how to get them to finish better at the rim? I mean, what's traditionally been done, and then what are you guys, you know, what challenges are you seeing and how are you trying to overcome it?
Yeah, one of the things has been that traditional at speed, 1 foot takeoff layup. And in FIBA basketball, there's no defensive 3 second rule. So, you know, we see a lot of zone, but importantly, right, when you get to the rim, 9 times out of 10, there's somebody waiting for you. That traditional, you know, outside, inside footwork, you know, right hand on right side of the basket finish kind of from your forehead and up just doesn't really exist much anymore. You may get one of those a game because there's a big blunder or you're out on the break on your own. But being able to slow your footwork down, you know, Euro step, play off a jump stop, a pro hop, dribble underneath, you know, through that Nash zone to kind of freeze that shot blocker. Mm-hmm. Those are the sort of areas that we're really big on developing right now, because they're non-traditional, but they're a lot more game specific. So it's really about the footwork and giving more options, to have a creative finish.
Right, and I'm curious on a couple of things. One, do you guys at the Performance Institute, do you dive much into like the skill acquisition type literature?
Yeah, look, the guys up there, I think they're world class. So they really tap into. Mm-hmm. So they have skill acquisition experts up there that work with a variety of the teams. They have their strength and conditioning staff. They have their basketball staff. Their assistants are incredibly curious about trying new things, about researching the best way to do things. And so they're very much at the cutting edge of trying to best provide a skill ACC program. And so it's always really valuable to get up there in that space and watch those guys.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see the different viewpoints in some of that skill acquisition pieces, especially as it's related to basketball. Because you have, I mean, yes, you have the footwork pieces of, all right, you got your Euro step, your windmill crossover step, your pro hop, etc. But it's also, you know, providing it with those perceptual cognitive type of abilities of, you know, what am I seeing and what does it mean? And, you know, how do I solve this problem in front of me, so to speak, in a reactive way? And, you know, there's various levels of to be able to, you know, create that problem solving ability. Yes, you can teach the footwork, but there's also ways of doing it of like, all right, you know, here's this quick snippet of information. Your goal is to make this layup. You know, how do you solve it? You know, how do you contort your body? How can you get into that space? How do you have to step? Where, you know, where's your release point going to be from, et cetera? You know, and there's, it's interesting to see how I've had the experiences on both ends. I've taught both ways with when I'm teaching kids, how some kids, if you teach them just like, okay, get to this gap, figure out a way to get it done, all of a sudden they'll start doing some of these windmill crossover and pro hop type things without you even like teaching it to them. And, you know, and then some people don't have that ability at all. So I was just wondering if you guys got into like, you know, experimenting with those different ways of, hey, this is the actual rigid footwork, or hey, this is the problem, and now try to solve it.
Yeah, we have. And I love that you use that term release point, because that's something that we've been talking about as well in terms of having between obviously you and I some consistent terminology, because I think that's a really big aspect of effective finishing. But it's definitely when we're in those kind of what you were talking about in creating those scenarios of, okay, in my 15-minute block, that first 5 minutes is, you know, 1v2, 1v1,
right.
whatever we've created. And I might have in my second 5 minutes, one on zero euro step, because I've identified that, you know, that's what we need to work on today. But if majority of the athletes are going through and using a jump stop shot fake step through, but aren't quite getting it right, well, the euro step's out the window. Right. And we'll come back and we'll talk about, you know, what those guys had been using and some ways for them to be more successful with it.
Right, right. Have you guys gotten into like the defensive side of things, of how to break things down and become better defenders?
Yeah, it's really interesting that you bring that up. One of the things that has filtered down from our national teams at recent World Cups, both senior and junior, is three focus areas that we felt like we were really lacking in to have better results. And that was shooting the basketball, ball security, particularly around passing, and 1v1 defense. And so for us, not only at junior national level, but filtering down to my everyday job, which is state development, getting back into being tenacious, hardworking defenders that Australians have a reputation of being is something that, we really put back to the forefront of our minds. So one of the biggest things we've started with is our closeouts. We felt like that was really the initial point of, a defense that needed improving. So we've stolen some things from the COE that we have to identify balls. So we're declaring ball. So that lets our teammates know we're closing it out. We have hand above ball always. So high hand early, hand remains above ball. So we never drop our hands below level of the ball. And then we talk about foot angles. And so different teams obviously will have different philosophies, you know, that traditional pack line, you know, you would force in the middle, you know, the old Bob Knight stuff, you know, force behind the backboard. We like to play square. So we're really squaring off, but are definitely trying to protect the nail as much as possible. So we'll have some sort of individual defense, or definitely two-way teach in the one-on-one to make sure that that's a focal point of ours in everything that we do.
So do you, and within that, as you're teaching kind of those basics, you know, you probably won't do this so much at the youth level, but at the elite level, as you get into film sessions, do you do any work with, and I think this has been done actually more in tennis and football, and it hasn't happened so much in basketball, is getting into some of those like temporal or spatial occlusion type techniques, so people can learn how to cue into, you know, what is the information that they need in order for them to make the right decision?
We haven't, and it's definitely an area that we know that we're lacking in. We've had a look at some software options to start doing that. We've been speaking as a coaching cohort around, you know, trying to show more film to just keep providing those different stimuli rather than just that basic on-court work. Something that we do talk about is just trying to get back to understanding your player first. So, you know, whether it's through a scouting report or knowing athletes and, you know, are they a shooter? Tendencies, tendencies, right, exactly. And that's, you know, a really basic but good way to help determine what sort of closeout, you know. Are they a great shooter? It's a longer closeout. You know, my hands have to be really active. They a poor shooter but a great driver. I'm going to give myself, you know, an extra step. And then with the older guys, we talk a little bit more about body position. You know, where are their hips? Where is the ball? Are they a threat? And that's kind of where we're at the moment. So really in the infancy stages, it'd be exciting to get into that next level.
As I've gotten more into, you know, biomechanics and teaching some small details, you know, when you're in those one-on-one sessions, you can teach into more things than you do with some of the bigger groups. And I'm always trying to read up on certain pieces of information. And that's one thing that I've been reading on a little bit that has been, you know, it hasn't really gotten into the basketball world so much. But I think it's a pretty interesting concept of being able to, yeah, what, you know, for you as a player, identifying what is the key information you need to look at. And it's not just from the defensive side, it's the same thing you can work on offense, because depending, you know, the quicker you can see those key details of how the hips move or how the foot moves or, you know, where the ball is, et cetera, whatever those key points of information are, you know, the quicker you're going to make those decisions, you know, regardless of how athletic you are, if you can see the game quick enough, you're going to be able to move more efficiently. And as a result, get better results for stops and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Look, I think that's a really good point. We've been discussing quite a bit here, and even some friends, we had a Zoom with Liam Flynn, who's a Australian coach currently in Israel. And we were talking about the importance of gaining data before the catch.
Right.
A couple of my sessions before we went away was just a simple, you know, we were spacing. It was a pass into a zero step catch versus a closeout. And all it was getting the receiver, getting our athletes to have eyes on the defender for as long as possible prior to the catch, and then associating hip position and foot position with that, so that, because what would happen more often than not is our players would be stagnant on the perimeter, so flat-footed,
and
toes, hips, and hands are facing the passer. So I'm almost parallel
to the rim.
Yeah, and then it's catch, pivot, and now I'm seeing what's happened, and usually I've been closed out by that time. The defense behind the primary defender has loaded up, and now I've got to go to, you know, some sort of jab series or whatever it may be to try and create a split. So for me, it was letting the athletes, guys, get the information first, get a snapshot of what the defense is doing prior to the ball getting in your hands, be a threat to get downhill or shoot, so be square to the rim, and then your catch and go or your catch and shoot is going to be a lot more prolific, and you're probably going to have a better chance to make a better decision. And that was really fun to watch the guys do that, because it was very foreign to me. Very foreign. But
and then when you're looking at from a skill acquisition perspective, how I've gone about like breaking some of those things down a little bit. I only bring this up because you said the word snapshot, and it calls to mind this drill that we'll do, and you can use it at any sport, from, you know, basketball, football, martial arts, et cetera, but call it the blink drill. Basically, you know, have the person in whatever stance they're going to be in on, whether it's on offense and defense. So let's say I'm on offense and I'm on the perimeter, I'm about to receive the ball. You know, if I'm in my ready stance of how things are going to be happening, I'll start with my eyes closed, and then really quickly I open them and I close them real quick. And then from there, I have to talk out all the different pieces of information that I see, from the foot to the knee, to the hip, to torso position, arms, et cetera, to help really get into my mind of, hey, this is what's happening. And now this is going to be the result as a result. So it's that whole concept of like slowing things down in order to allow things to speed back up. And it's really interesting to see as a result then the type of changes that will happen within the player, because he can, you know, it's almost like you get things so you can see it in slow motion, so to speak. Is that something that you guys have worked with before?
No, I love that. I'm going to steal that. It's the Eric drill in the Northern Hemisphere, but it's now the drill in the Southern. So, I think that's fantastic. You know, we went with progressions of 1v1 and then 1v2, 1v3, and then we added the passer to a 2v3. with the idea of trying to look beyond the primary defender, but we didn't have anything to go back. And so I think that's a really cool way of coming back a step, particularly for those guys that may be struggling. And I can just see it now, you know, putting the defender in different positions with a lead foot, you know, something to attack or hands down, something to shoot, whatever it may be. So yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, not at all. I'm just glad you brought up that keyword, and it's something that I've, I've been reading into a lot more lately, and I've kind of gone back to it. And yeah, I'm just glad you brought that up. And we're able, again, this podcast is all about sharing and getting people better. So I do find that as a great drill, and I'm glad you find interest in it as well. Definitely, I'm glad you can make use of it. So down there, you also within the semi-professional or the youth teams, is that just clubs or do you have academies? I mean, how do they get into that elite path down there?
Yeah, so we start at grassroots, which is our domestic program. That's that kind of rec league. And that starts as young as under eights. And so under eights, under 10s, under 12s, 14s, 16s, and then keeps going. And then from the grassroots, you can move into the club environment. And then the club basketball, which plays in that VJBL down here in Victoria, basically you need to be in that club environment to move to where I am, what we call our high-performance pathway. We have a high school, a number of high school leagues, but they are not considered priorities. There's still some good competition there, and good coaches, good athletes, but it's very much club orientated, similar to Europe. And so if you you show potential and talent through the club, you can move into some tryout phases for the elite pathway. And then from there we have development programs and performance programs. So in the country, we have an under 14 academy, which is regional. And then we have an all-state program, which is called the State Development Program, where we have 10 hubs around the state, both metro and country. And they're players that we've identified that have potential to play for state teams at our Australian Junior Championships. Okay. And then we have a program above that called the Victorian National Performance Program, and they're athletes that we've identified that have the potential to play for Australia one day. And they're that's a lot more of a controlled environment, smaller group, where myself and the other high performance head coaches are a lot more hands on.
Okay. So what's you said when they can try out for the elite program, but as they get through the club, they can go either through a development pathway or an elite pathway. I mean, what's the difference between the two?
Yeah. So the state development program is a lot broader, including the academy. It's cast a wider net. It's being brave with our selections, you know, that 6'2" under 14 kid who can't walk and chew gum at the same time, but we know, you know, has that potential to be, you know, that physical specimen that we want later on. So that one's, and then that one, you know, building a base, you know, teaching a lot of concepts and national style of play areas to just hopefully, we see that spark, we see that jump in development that would move them across into that performance program. Mm-hmm. The performance program is, we still can be brave, but it's a little bit more, okay, we see it now, you know, elite shooter, elite ball handler, like they have an area of their game that
they have elite something.
They have elite something, 100%. And we have players in that program that have already represented Australia at a junior national level. So, that's a really fun program to be involved in. You know, I mean, that's coaching the best of the best, which is, you know, obviously as a coach, that's where you want to be and most fun.
Right. So within the development year or within the season, first of all, is Australia one of those countries that you can play multiple sports throughout the year, you know, kind of play one, then the next, or is it similar to Europe where it's like, hey, you know, 12, 13 years old, if you're part of this club, if you're serious, you got to play this year round. I mean, how is that divvied up? How's that structured?
Okay, I didn't know this was going to be a 6-hour podcast, but okay, here we go. this is a conversation we're having consistently around. We know that generalization is better than specialization, but we have so basketball here is actually year round. I think overall it's like 6 weeks. 6 to 8 weeks in the year they don't play. Otherwise, it's constantly, constantly going. Winter sports that coincide is AFL, so our football down here, netball, soccer. When it comes to summer, you know, cricket, volleyball. So there's always things going on. There's definitely a competitiveness. Once we get to that kind of 15, 16, 17-year-old space around trying to get athletes to narrow their focus, and obviously that's where we want them with basketball. So there is room for them to do a lot of sports. There's room for them to specialize. It's really having conversations with the family. It's having conversations with coaches. It's trying to find a balance and trying to help them enjoy their sport and stay in sport as long as they can. It's a funny one. It's actually there's a player that I coached in the under 16 state team who went up to the AIS as a scholarship holder, played for the junior national teams, ended up getting a scholarship to SMU. But he now plays for Collingwood Football Club in the AFL. And so, you know, like really talented. But now as a professional footballer, and for me, I was kind of a little bit upset, like a lot of our other coaches get with that. But then I went to Collingwood and got to visit him there in that program and realized one of the best things about basketball is how elite we are. We're an Olympic sport.
Yeah.
You have to be really, really good to make it, and not everybody does. And he got to enjoy basketball. Yeah. He probably wasn't going to be the professional that he wanted to be, but he was able to switch to football and have a career being paid to play sport. And I just think that's awesome, and it's helped me change my mindset about those sorts of things. So. Yeah, it's interesting.
Right. Yeah, no, it is. And so I didn't know I'd be bringing up such a hot topic, but I, you know, things are so different around the world. It's always interesting to see how different cultures and different countries view things as they do. And, you know, I think outside of the U.S., I think the U.S. is one of the last places to, you know, have those four sport yearly athletes where they'll go from one thing to the next and they can do it all the way up through high school. You know, in Europe, obviously it's not that way. It doesn't sound like it is in Australia. So it's, and then you have, like up in the Nordic countries in Norway, for example, what they will do, in their elite sports path type program is they go and they basically just teach movement patterns all the way up until, you know, kids are 13, 14 years old. And then from there, then they say, okay, well, what do you, and sometimes even later, 15, 16, but then they're like, all right, well, what do you want to be, you know, professional in, so to speak? What do you love the most? And so it's just all about motor learning. And then it's like, well, whatever you love the most, now we'll put you down that pathway. But they don't really do a ton of, you know, competition type stuff. And granted, they're a winter sport Olympic type country, but it's a very interesting approach in comparison to the rest of the world.
Yeah, that's really cool when you get that exposure to all the different programs and ways of doing things. It's I always really love hearing about, you know, how other people are exploring sport and development of athletes. One of the things that I think not necessarily hurts us, but is such an important aspect when considering generalization versus specialization is shooting the basketball.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the master skill. And it is right. difficult. It needs so much repetition, finding that balance of putting in the work to that part of the game, but also, you know, doing things like movement and enjoyment of other right. sports is such an interesting balance to try and find in young people.
Well, and I think with as much as we know about skill acquisition and how it is developed, you know, there are those key kind of components of each sport, you know, mentally, physically, technically, tactically, where, you know, if you were to play multiple sports throughout the year, although you might have these couple of things, okay, this is my, you know, my focus right now is soccer. Well, great. You have your tactical practices and you'll have some skill things and so on and so forth. But hey, a couple of times a week, you know, shooting a basketball, working on specific things for that define your role or that you want to get better at, so on and so forth. I mean, it doesn't take much to maintain or even make little improvements when it comes to that. And to be able to put together an academy or a type of program that has like that approach where you can play multiple sports and you can compete at a high level. And you just kind of do your supplementary work throughout the year when you're not in season. I think that would be like a real cool concept to work with. I think that would be so much fun for the kids and for everybody else.
No, I couldn't agree more. Having the luxury of, you know, being with the same kids, right. And having the ability to say, hey, today we're going to play soccer, or today we're going to experiment right. with lacrosse, or today we, you know, whatever it may be, would be awesome. That's an interesting. I just realized I'm saying interesting quite a lot. I must be enjoying conversation. Yeah. We talk a lot about skill ack and how it relates to other sports and enjoyment. And I just think if we had the time, it would be great, because so many of our athletes, even just in basketball, in a 12-month period, may right. have five or six different coaches just in basketball.
Right.
And so obviously right. that can be a bit of a mountain to climb as well.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny though, because if you have a group of coaches or even a couple of coaches that coach multiple sports, if you understand like a few basic things in each sport, I mean the footwork and balance, and especially in team sports, and you know, and then you have your different cuts, you have your different feints, you have your different fakes, etc. I mean, a lot of them carry over, crossover steps, jab steps, slide steps, hesitations, like a lot of those things, although the actual end result, whether it's with a lacrosse stick or a soccer ball or a basketball, like a lot of those things are extremely similar. And the more you're able to make those connections as a person, as far as like how things are supposed to feel in different atmospheres, the more your body becomes more efficient in those ways. And it builds that confidence, it builds that efficiency. And I just think kids would have a ball doing that type of thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's a great point, and hopefully we keep moving towards a sporting world that's like that, you know, one day soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, sorry, I'll get off my stump here. I just that's something I've thought of on a lot, and you know, when certain conversations take me in those directions, you know, sometimes I just can't help myself but dive in, so to speak. All right, so. We're getting here towards the end of the hour. How's your time? You got, I'm sure you're busy today. You got to be getting going here soon.
No, all good. I blocked it out for this. I'm really enjoying talking. So if you got a couple extra ones, shoot.
Yeah. All right, cool. So when we come, let's talk a little bit more about the, you know, skill act, throughout the year, you know, how you kind of segment it for the professional players. You know, obviously they have to have a little bit more focus on recovery. They got to take care of their bodies. You know, you in that off season is you know, you have that development. And so you have more time to kind of be in the gym, work on your own skills. And then when you get to the year, it's much more tactical team stuff. And especially in Australia and Europe, it's, you know, you'll have four or five practices dedicated to developing a game plan for this team. Not all the time, but, you know, it's much different than the NBA when you have 82 games and, you know, you're playing three games in 5 nights. So speak a little bit to how those skills are developed in the off season and the differences in during the end season and how that's approached.
Yeah. With the off season stuff, it's very much about the individual athlete. It's getting down to the detail of what we need to put in place for the season ahead, you know, identifying those, you know, maybe three or four areas that we really want to solidify for the start of the year. And then when we get into the season, and one of the experiences I had when I was in Ballarat coaching the men's pro team there was we had, because we're in regional Victoria, and we had, I think we had six players that were on our payroll. And then we had another one or two that were studying at the time. So we had between 6 to 8 athletes for our four workouts during the day. So we would have midday workouts, and then we would have team practice Tuesday night, Thursday night, play on the weekend. And we'd have some shooting, just some specific shooting sessions built around that. But so what I found with the higher volume of athletes that I was able to get during the day, we would maybe do between 10 and 20 minutes of a 60-minute session on some skill act stuff around, you know, maybe some outside hand push passing or using a counter move or a breakdown move, whatever it may be. And then we would get into 40 minutes of small-sided games where we could break down some of those actions within our playbook, you know, whether it was our motion or our sets or whatever it may be. And help the guys with decision making and developing some creative outcomes within that, and that was a real bonus. I really enjoyed being able to shape a season that way, working individually at the start, but then being able to have those breakdown sessions. So then, when Tuesday and Thursday night rolled around, they were really macro, a lot of 5-on-5, a lot of team based stuff. Maximizing those 2 hours, so that was cool. That was a fun way of doing things. I would definitely try and mimic that again if I could.
Mm-hmm. And that's during the season. And they, you know, as you said, it's a year long sport there, so you don't really have that. You know, you have that 6 to 8 week off season, and I'm sure that's more just kind of recovery, getting away from the game. Is what it sounds like.
Yeah, well, a lot of the leagues kind of cross over. So, you know, we would get guys from the NBL, you know, potentially 4 weeks before the start of our season. And then some of them would start leaving us towards the end of our season to do the NBL preseason. So your periodization for them was different to the other guys. And, you know, that load management and balancing and having conversations with the NBL club, the physio, the coaching staff. Hey, you know, this is what we've got going this week. Okay, this is what we have. Let's find a balance of how to work together. It's a unique experience. And, you just have to continue to have that athlete-centric model and you know, it's trying to be fair but not equal,
right? And a lot of that, it's like we talked about early on, is just that communication with the player. You know, how are you feeling, how are things, what do you feel that you need, you know, especially at those elite levels, to be able to make sure, you know. And that's something that Joy spoke of a lot previously as well, is hey, this is what you know, my national team is doing, this is what we're doing right here. How do we make this customized game plan to make sure that, you know, whether I'm down here in Australia or I'm up with the Chinese Taipei national team, like, I'm going to be able to perform, you know. And that's, you know, that's obviously a credit to you guys that it's not, hey, I'm this is how we're going to do it. And, you know, just, this is the only thing that's important. It's, you got to take the person into account and all the person's needs and to help, you know, help them to achieve their highest levels of success as much as possible.
Yeah. I think being a pretty young basketball nation kind of helps us there, that we're always keen to, right, to build relationships with other coaches and other nations, to help develop, the game here at home. And yeah, I mean, Joy's a great example. Like, I remember having, you know, some phone conversations with her national team coach and just saying, okay, you know, what are you guys doing? You know, what can we work on here that's going to help her? And I think that, yeah, that integration, it is not only great for the athlete, which is, you know, our primary focus, but great as a coach to have those conversations and, yeah, potentially say, oh, okay, cool. I've got to work on that, or I've got to build that skill or hone that technique. Awesome. You know, let me go do some research or let me find some ways to best be able to do that.
Yeah. Now, do your players down there, do most of them that want to play elite, do a lot of them have that goal of, hey, I want to play college in the States, or do they want to stay kind of local within the country?
Very much so. I would still say between 90% and 95% of our athletes in our programs want to go the U.S. college pathway.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's a big part of what we talk about on a regular basis. We actually have a whole arm of Basketball Australia dedicated to helping athletes do that, called BA Pathways. Okay. And then we provide information around schooling, you know, what classes our kids need to be taking. We have some really good relationships with coaches in the States. We've got some coaches, Australian coaches now, you know, in associate head coaching roles over there in D1 programs. That's a cool aspect of what we do. And you know, when we see our athletes go off and achieve that dream, I mean, that's what coaching is all about. Actually, funny enough, this afternoon, we have a Zoom session with both our SDP and VMPP program, where we have an athlete, Josh Coonan, who's currently at the University of San Francisco. He's going to jump on and have a discussion with the kids around life of a student athlete, and, you know, give the younger ones a little bit of exposure to what a day to day on campus is like. So we're really looking forward to that.
So obviously he's not the only one to have gone that route, but how is the response typically from the kids that do come to the States and then play at that Division I level and come back? I mean, what's usually the feeling or the thoughts that they have coming back after they experience a year of basketball here in the States?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a unique environment in so many ways around being a student athlete. The brand of basketball, its different rules, the type of athlete in, you know, incredibly, you know, strong, powerful, quick, you know, African American athletes that our kids aren't used to playing can make the experience, kind of go one of two ways. Most of our elite guys who have usually gone via the COE do really well and love the experience. Like Dejan Vasiljevic, who's currently at the University of Miami, you know, he's, you know, finishing his fourth year, has just had an exceptional career there. But we've had a lot of other guys, you know, transfer maybe down to more mid majors or decided to come home early just because they weren't ready for it, or it just wasn't what they were expecting. And then also to credit our NBL, providing a development pathway. So there's some spots on a roster for what's called a development player. So it gives players now the opportunity to go directly to the NBL. We're finding a lot of the athletes are deciding to do that. So that's great that our league is has built that weight to do that and to challenge the US college pathway. So it's still, yeah, you know, very much like US kids, it's still what's the best thing for you.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's interesting how Australia is coming into, you know, some of these decisions, some of the high schoolers are even making in the States. I mean, was it LaMelo Ball that went down there and played there this past year? And similarly, I've heard now more, actually not heard, but this past year, now that the G League is changing its rules, where instead of you having to go to college to play in the NBA, you can forego college and you can go right into the G League. So was it Jalen, what's his face? He's a Chicago product too. Jalen something, not Jalen Brown. He's the guy from the Celtics. But one of the top recruits just said, yeah, I'm foregoing, you know, my collegiate years. I'm going right to the G League. And another kid from UCLA, who was one of the, you know, top 20 recruit, I think it was, you know, he just pulled out too. He's like, yeah, but I'm going to go to the G League now too. And so to see that Australia has that option now down there, that would be interesting to see how even that plays out. And then it's the game is becoming more and more international, where kids are, once they get through those high school years, they're like, hey, where can I just go play basketball, make a little money, and learn?
Yeah.
It's becoming more and more of that.
Totally. I mean, as an Australian, I think it's a feather in the cap of our league that we have been not a threat, but have challenged the NBA to have to make those rule changes. I think that's a real credit to the guys involved in our league here. And obviously, you know, with those, 20-hour contact rules in NCAA, you know, when you're saying to a really elite prospect, right, you know, who wants to play for a living, that, you know, you can play professionally straight away and work on your game 24/7. Obviously, that's pretty enticing. So I think the landscape is going to continue to, right, change. As these guys get better and better and want to focus on their basketball earlier.
Yeah. So that kind of brings me to another thing that I know is a big issue in Denmark. And I want to hear how they do it down there. You know, these dual career pathways, you know, the basketball is only going to bounce for so long. How does Australia manage the fact that, like, okay, we have these athletes that want to play at high levels in these different sports, but at the same time, we know education is very important. And you guys are, you know, you don't have that collegiate necessarily like experience. It's all through the clubs, from what I understand. So how do you manage that dual career pathway to allow, you know, student athletes and people that are going to be playing sports, but, you know, something else eventually down the line, to be able to succeed at both?
It's something that we're really conscious of. The NBL in particular, particularly with those development players, really encourages, yeah, those athletes to study on a part-time basis, to not only, you know, help with education and life after basketball, but also just to give them something else to do, so that, you know, the brain's being, right, stimulated away from the court. So they really go. The WNBL, right, is really good at it too. They're really on top of athletes, you know, staying involved in their education. The AFL does a fantastic job with their programs around providing other avenues and pathways for players. So it's something that each team and each league, just tries to do on a player by player basis.
Okay. So, I mean, it's a known thing, issue, so to speak, and you guys are, you know, you put in the necessary resources to allow the athletes to be able to do both, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, we do. And because in the NBL and WNBL in particular, it's, you know, such a small league, it's very hands-on. You know, it allows, yeah, for a lot more of that, you know, individual attention to what players, you know, may be looking to do. You know, do they want to pursue coaching? Do they want to pursue business? Whatever it may be. And you'll find that a lot of,
right,
head coaches and CEOs support the athletes in doing that. And, you know, that may be something where they would speak to me, you know, and say, hey, we've got this athlete in the off season. Can you help with a coaching position for them? Or, you know, can they come and do some camps or whatever it may be, and continuing to provide a support network around those guys? Because, I think we're really good in this country about, you know, trying to support athletes in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So getting towards the end here, just a quick non-related question here. Have you ever had any experience in the Big V League? I think that's like the summer league down there or something like that.
Yeah, so the Big V is underneath the NBL one. So our top tier is the NBL, gotcha. Or WNBL. The next tier down is the NBL one. And then the next tier down is our more local state-based competition. And in Victoria, it's the Big V, Big V for Victoria. And the U23 team that I coached is in that competition. And then also I've had to jump on some staffs with a few different teams to support some coaches in a variety of ways. So, and then I actually played in the Big V when I first came around a long, long time ago. So, yeah, I've had a bit of experience with that competition. The guys that are involved in that do a great job.
Yeah, a couple of my boys played in that before. I don't know if you know them or not. Skylar Bolin and Grant Johnson. Do any of those, either of those names ring the bell?
Yeah, the second one for sure. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. Grant, he grew up in the same hometown as I did back in the day. And he's a great dude. He can play. He's a good dude.
Right. Oh, well, they're going to have to come out now.
Definitely. Gonna have to. Yeah, no, he's a great guy. All right, cool. That'll just about wrap it up for things that I want to get through on my end. Thanks for being on, Nathan. If people want to get in touch with you, how do they do it?
On Twitter, at CoachNCB is a good one. My email address is nathancb@basketballvictoria.com.au. And always keen to connect with people and talk basketball and share the game. So thanks very much for having me, Eric. Again, I appreciate being able to come on and work with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Much appreciated. We'll be in touch.
Awesome. Thanks again.